to another episode of Cattle HQ. I'm your host, Olivia Amundson, here with my colleague, Kiernan Grant. Today, we are here with John Mose and Dr. George Perry, and we're going to talk a little bit about preparing for the breeding season. So, John and Dr. Perry, I will let you both introduce yourself, and I'll probably start with Dr. Perry.
Thanks, Olivia. So I'm now at Texas A&M AgriLife at the Research Center in Overton, Texas. Out at the Research Center, we actually maintain three separate herds that we pretty much do year-round calving based upon the herd they're in. But we do everything from reproduction to production all the way through collecting feedlot data here. And so my program and the situation here allows me to really focus on beef cattle management and things that impact production efficiency. Before that, I was at South Dakota State for 17 years. And so that's where John and I got to know each other.
And you were also my graduate advisor. Let's make sure to tell our crowd that. So my wonderful mentor is here with us today. John, why don't you give us a brief introduction as well?
I guess John Mose, owner and operator with my son Brian of Mose Feedlot up here. We got a cow-calf operation of 300 head, plus we've got a feedlot of 2,000 head that we try and custom feed under monoslope barns. We keep busy. When you start looking at this reproduction and everything, we started way back in 2003 when George said he was 17 years at SDSU. When he started in 2003, he come up to a meeting in Watertown and was talking on reproduction, and we got to talking, and he was looking for some herds in the area other than just the two herds at Antelope and the one down at STSU in Brookings to take and come out and have some real life experiences on just a normal setting, because at that time they always said, oh, geez, they've got these college cattle and they've got them so fine-tuned this way and that way. This way, they got really live actual of them. And that year, it was a noon dinner. And then afterwards, he talked about synchronizing heifers. And he was trying to get together a study on a group of heifers. If you take and send half of them to grass the 1st of May, and the other half, you leave in the feedlot until after they were bred, and then turn them out and just see what your conception rate was, see if it'd be the same. Well, we did that on the first group of heifers back in 2003, the summer of 2003, and we found where once you breed them and throw them right out on grass, naive, let them be naive compared to the ones that were on grass, our conception rate was less because they had to reformulate their nutrition plan. So when we talk about nutrition and everything on this, it started way back almost two decades ago on that. So it really, and we've been going from then on. We did, I had my brother-in-law's cattle that I'd bring in here, and he'd bring them in March. We would breed them in May, and they would take and bring them here 2 months before. And we put them on a hay and a diet of grass, alfalfa mix hay, and 5 pounds of corn, plus a good mineral program. And as soon as we bred them, we started, after we learned from this episode, we would take them heifers and they would take them home as soon as we AI'd them. Heat detect for 72 hours, and we would take them and put them on grass, but they would take and top dress corn at 5 pounds a day to them for the next 2 weeks. And we started seeing no substantial difference in pregnancy rates.
Yeah, John, that was good. That has me wanting to go in like five different directions right now. But you said something that you and Dr. Perry have been working together for about two decades now. How has things changed on your operation since you started working with Dr. Perry?
Well, I can bring you a little story up. When he first started coming, we used to always say he'd come once a year and preg check in the fall and ultrasound them. And And we just started with the bred heifers and the first calvers, and now we're breeding every cow AI wants in different groups with different protocols. But when that first started, after we started doing this, I kind of laughed. My wife would, we'd have dinner for George when he was up here, and my wife would say, how many, we need Christmas presents. It's usually around Christmas time. So how many open cows do we have for Christmas? And it started with that. Well, then it excelled from that to the point where, okay, now we can, we're to the point where we got these cows so fine-tuned that we don't start selling cows because they're open. We start selling cows for disposition, udders, feet, and carcass data. And we started way back when, in the last 7-8 years, it's been 6-8 years ago, we were down at Sioux Falls in Georgia, remember this. I was one of the speakers on it, as far as we had 46 to 50% CABs on loads of cattle going out. And it's just changed the with what we've been doing. We're getting better herd health. Now, like I said, instead of selling them for not being bred, we're selling for disposition. And we've got cows that are, the oldest cow is 15, 16 years old, and she's still either eight-eyed or first bull bred. They're still in the herd.
Yeah, John, I think you've said a lot of, or brought a lot of concepts within that statement there. So you're breeding your cows, you're seeing it an increase in herd health, you're able to cull cows based on disposition and different things like that, maybe structural soundness, things that you weren't necessarily able to do before, even selling, you know, on a grid instead of selling at the sale barn. And so I guess maybe I'll turn the conversation over to Dr. Perry, and can you elaborate a little bit more on using some of these reproductive technologies in terms of some of the production efficiency on a commercial herd?
Well, yeah, and that's one of the things when we first started working with John, after the first 3 or 4 years, we really had a discussion that really came out. And, you know, my philosophy on things is, any of the research we do should be practically applicable. I like seeing what we're doing, that we can put it in production and how it impacts things. And as John started seeing, once you get reproduction where you want it up in the high levels, then management really takes over. So now, instead of saying, I need to maintain my cow herd to pay my bills, now it's kind of, that cow had the poorest performing calf the past 2 years. She can go because I have somebody else that can take her place and do better. And that's actually been one of the funnest things in working with John over the past 2 decades, is seeing that and seeing how going from just breeding replacement heifers and having them enter the herd to now only keeping replacement heifers that are out of AI sires, and seeing the sires that, okay, disposition was a little bit different, so they didn't stay as long, but longevity in a herd and being able to manage that herd as a group, because you do have good, tight reproductive synchrony in them, allows you the opportunity to make management decisions that'll affect profitability.
Well, and we've spent quite a bit of time up at John and Brian's place, and they are incredibly in touch with that side of things. And really, this is just a true testament to the extent of a functional and well-established relationship with extension to that community of producers that we are trying to reach. You know, I think it's ridiculously cool that you guys have been doing this for almost 20 years now, and to see how far this has really transitioned. And I mean, every time I get the opportunity to go up and go through the feedlot, I mean, that's one of the most exciting parts of my job, is getting to walk through with incredibly dialed in, savvy producers that have all of these foundational components truly dialed in to the extent where we can get incredibly nitpicky and start looking at those drivers of profitability, like carcass quality, where really advanced nutritional management and being really dialed in on that front can be super beneficial. And, you know, Dr. Perry, I'd love to just hear your thoughts. You know, when I started in extension, and Olivia's used to hearing this running around South Dakota, we hear oftentimes how extension is the best kept secret in South Dakota. And I'm sure you've heard that in Texas too, but maybe just talk a little bit about the potential for collaborations that you've been able to see over your tenure as an extension research professional.
Well, for me, I get benefits both ways. And so I see the benefits on the extension side and the direct impacts on the beef industry. But as you also mentioned, I have a large research appointment and am interested in what we can do to make things better. And so we're better to learn from than working with producers and seeing what is impacting them and what changes we need to learn about to help make things better. But that relationship is very important. And that's one of the things with John, when we first started doing things in that, there was never a day we showed up that there weren't students from Lake Area Tech, that are the neighbors. I never knew who was going to be there when we pulled up. And most of the time they were questioning John on why in the world are you doing this? And as you see over the years, how he's been able to demonstrate what we do and what we talk about in extension, and the proponents like John that can come out and tell the neighbors, hey, here's the benefit of this. Here's what I look at, how my herd has changed. And that's the exponential growth of extension, because we can't get out and talk to everybody. And so getting out and having, it really is a two-way street when you have the high quality producers that you can work with, that both programs gain from it. And that's where we see the real growth and benefits to the industry. And that's what extension is supposed to be.
What, one thing, Olivia, I kind of want to add, when he talks about high quality producers, we were just a commercial herd when we started. We bought cows. We've started AI probably 25 years ago, and it just excelled. And we didn't use a lot of the top name bulls. I was looking for, when I first started, it was growth bulls, and looking at yearling weights of over 120 to 140. And it never, ever hurt us on doing that situation. Our cow herd, our calves are all, they're right in the carcass quality is there. I guess one thing, like when George talks about getting out, and the reason why we started was, I always says, we're state of the art anymore. And I'm not trying to brag it up or anything, but we take the initiative to, we've got performance beef program in here. Now Zoetis bought that performance beef program a year ago here, and they've got the health side on it now. And now just seeing this last week where performance beef and on the health side, they're going to get a cow calf part of program in there for the cow calf that Zoetis is putting together on this performance beef. And it's all that we use in the feedlot. And it's just trickling down now to the cow calf side, where we can start using that for our data and just seeing the rate of gain on these calves and seeing what's doing. And when we first started this way back in the early 2000s, we had a successful farmer always come out, and they always had these articles starting to synchronize and do some of this stuff. And a lot of that stuff was through extension that brought that to the successful farmer, the farm journal. And you read some of that, and like I've always told Brian, I says, if we don't use it, we're going to lose it. And he's gotten to the point where he's more tech savvy than I am, and to get this stuff going. But I got to look at them to find the numbers, when what numbers I want. And we found where a lot of this just keeps filtering up, and it's not going backwards. So it's a lot of it, if you don't use this technology and if we can get it out here, we've got it in real life hands And like I said, we were just a commercial herd. We're still a commercial herd. We're not registered, but these cattle can just about be registered. So that's where we're going from.
Yeah, John, I mean, in being an extension myself, and I think Kiernan can even agree with this, you know, we both not only enjoy going to your place, but I feel like we learn something new every time we are there. And it's those things that we learn that we can bring to our other producers, where you've already kind of tested and proven some of these things that you're doing. And so we really appreciate you, you know, stepping out and trying some of these things to continue moving forward. Because without you, then I feel like that needle never turns. So with that, I think we should kind of talk about, you know, we've kind of just dabbled in the importance of preparing for the breeding season. And we kind of got quick into that conversation without really talking about how you prepare for your breeding season. So you use estrus synchronization. What kind of protocol are you using? There's different estrus synchronization protocols out there, and I'll let Dr. Perry maybe get into the weeds about that here in a little bit. But John, what do you use, and why do you prefer using that type of a protocol?
I guess the last 2-3 years with the testing and stuff, and we've always been using the 7-day seeder, and then different protocols with different doses of GnRH in between, in along with the luteolize, and some of that's been working. One thing I've noticed from in the past, we've always been, and George probably laugh at some of this, but the last year and a half, or the last 2 years, instead of 72 hours going in and time breeding, I've taken it on to my initiative to wait on those cows that aren't showing heat at 72 hours. And I've been breeding them at 78 hours instead of in the morning, been breeding them that afternoon and then giving a shot of GnRH. And then like this last year, we're getting another 3-4% more bred, and we're heat detecting. We have not, until this last year, we have not used time AIN. Now, this year we use time AIN. Is it nice? Yes. In 2 hours, you can breed 100 cows. But you know what? From what I can see, we were at 62 to 63% on time AI, just for an example this year. I can see we can get 5, almost up to 10% more by heat detecting. People can take it for what it's worth. But for us, 10% on 300 cows, that's 30 head of calves that are going to calve in day one. And you take that 30 head of calves out of 300 in day one, you got 20 days. That's 60 pounds a calf at 2 pounds a day, or at 3 pounds on feed. 60 pounds or even 40 pounds, you start looking at that. You can bring them up almost a half a month sooner to be done on the market. We're finishing all of our calves last 5, 6, 7 years now. And it's to the point where it really shows value in us to get them to all calve up there at day one that much more. And then at one nice thing about it is at day 23, we're probably 80% done calving in 23, 24 days. People say, why are you doing this? And like George said it very well here, we've got people that come here and help us, and people, well, geez, look at the extra work you got going on. Look at what you're doing. And they keep saying this, and it's paying off in the long run. And it's not only helping us, it's helping Extension and George, as far as there's a lot of protocols in these AI magazines that are from the Extension. People don't realize who's done these numbers, who's done these trials. And that's where it's coming from, is Extension's done all these trials, and the colleges have helped with that as far as to get it out there on a commercial basis.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. So like you said, Extension researchers have really, I mean, it's going on to places like yours where they've gotten all these numbers. And like you said, you prefer the heat detection and AI, but there's also, you know, strict timed AI. Dr. Perry, do you want to elaborate on, as a researcher standpoint, what some of these different protocols mean and how they can affect producers, I guess, differently or.
So, yeah, one of the questions, and I get phone calls and everything all the time that is, tell me what protocol I should use. And really, especially if I'm at a meeting or that, or somebody just calls me, it's kind of, that's the worst question to ask. And people look at me when I answer that question that way. And it's kind of, we have protocols that work. We have protocols that work well, but to tell you what's going to work the best on your operation, I need to know what you're doing and what your operation's like. And so as John pointed out, and all the work we've done over the years, almost all of it, other than the past couple of years, has been with heat detection. And in a herd that does a tremendous job heat detecting, and there's several of them that I've worked with, if you switch to a fixed time AI, you don't see any improvement. And actually, just like John pointed out, you're going to see a little bit of reduction. Herds that don't put in the effort to do a good job detecting estrus, I can show you herds that have a 10% improvement by going to fixed time AI because they didn't put in the effort to do heat detecting. And so you have to know those situations. And, you know, a cow in standing heat is always going to have the best fertility because she is there. She's ready to be bred. And so when I talk about synchronization protocols, I talk more about understanding what they're doing. And when we look at the research and stuff we're doing, it's understanding what might get us better control of follicular growth or what get us better timing on things, and not necessarily looking at just a fixed time AI, but the project we're involved with this year is actually comparing two fixed time AI protocols that go about synchronizing in totally opposite ways. One of them tries to get rid of the corpus luteum at the start of the protocol to get better response to GnRH. The other one tries to induce a persistent follicle. And so even though one of the protocols has been around for a while, the other one's newer, we don't know the best situation they work in. And one of the things we're learning is when we've got herds all across the country that are supplying data for it, when we look at that, there's different situations, and we're about halfway through the study, but when we look at that, if the cow has started cycling, if she's in good body condition, good days postpartum, if she's cycling, all of those things, and it's going to be interesting to see these different methods, where does one work better than the other? And it's understanding those things, and it's getting, as you pointed out, Olivia, the herds we can get the data back from to know postpartum interval, cyclicity status, you know, that'll let us take the blood samples to determine cyclicity, that we know body condition, things like that, that then we can come through and say, okay, and for making recommendations, if you're in a herd that is not in as good a cyclicity or body condition isn't as good, this protocol might be better than that one. And so anything with any of them, and with synchronization is a tool we can use, and it will never compensate for bad management. A herd that has good overall management will have good success with synchronization. Herds with bad management, you can do the best protocol there is, and it's still going to turn out bad. And so it's literally a tool we can utilize. And in good herds, it works well, but you have that give and take. The time for estrus detection versus a fixed time AI. There's give and take on time management. There's give and take on labor. And we need to weigh all of those things into the different operations to figure out what's going to work the best for you.
One thing to bring up, Olivia, like I said, this year we time AI'd. One thing that I would like to bring up on that is some of these people that have never done anything in a time AI, they might, and we're looking to see right now when they come in 21 days later, let's see what the conception rate is there. It might be in 23 days, some of these other ones, just like George said, we're to the point where we know what our statistics are for the last 20 years. And we're trying to better ourselves. And like I said, I could see that we shot ourselves in the foot by just time AIing, but we're still only going to maybe be 21 days off. And I think our conception rate on the first bull bred, I think, was pretty high, if I remember right. We don't have all the statistics back from that this year, but when we start calving in March and we get the middle of April, when them start coming, I think we're going to see that we're only missed that 10% or that 5% or 6%. We're only probably 21 days later, where some of these herds, if they're on a time like that and go throw bulls in, they probably think that'd be heaven for them to have that many calves in 24 days. So it, like George said, it all depends on the situation, but we've been in it long enough that we can see what we're doing and what works. And I think he said it very well as far as getting to heat detect. And if we heat detect very well, we go out there and sit at night at 9:30 at night, and we're there at 6 in the morning. And we see those ones that are starting to come around. And it all depends on how you're going to do that. And then when do you breed them? If you breed them that next morning right away, or if you breed them that night. So you get them bred. And then what we do, one thing is for getting them in kicked in gear is we take the first 100 cows that calve. They go in the first group. Well, they're the farthest postpartum. They're the first ones that get bred every year, which makes a lot of difference. The last ones to calve are the last ones to get bred. Your postpartum dates, you're not throwing where you get these other herds. They might run the whole herd. Oh, we're going to breed this day. Well, some of them probably only postpartum 25 days or not even that, where ours are all probably 90 days postpartum before we breed them. So it makes a difference there too on how we set them up. But we got them in groups of 100. Well, that's what we breed is 100 head. So we can just go get that 100 head of cows. We don't have to go out and sort off of 300 head. Oh, geez, which ones were they? That makes a lot of difference too.
And you just made me think of something, John, after you said you break them up into three groups of 100, because I think a lot of times people get really intimidated with estrus synchronization because they have this thought that all their cows are going to calve on the same day. And of course that we all know that that's not necessarily the case, but I like how you run your operation. And so you break your 300 cows up into three groups of 100, and then you synchronize them in a way that you synchronize and then breed one week. You breed the second group the next week and the third group the next week. Am I right?
Correct. And then when we bring them in, the first two synchronizer groups, if we got 63%, we're going to have 125 head of cows that are going to calve in 7 days, say. Well, they might start 5-6 days early and it'll be 5 days late. So there's a 10-day period that you're going to have 100 or 60 calves from that first group. And then that second group will be starting and we just never, ever stop. You got them, but you're almost a 10-day period, five to 6 days early and 5 days after you breed them on the due date is where, yeah, you're not going to calve 60 head one day. You breed 100. If you get 70%, you're going to have 70 calves. You're going to have 10 a day. Heck, we have some days we'll have up to 20 a day is our biggest day with doing this, but you got enough room and it works. So that's one of the strategies that we use.
And I think that's good. That's a really good point to make, because even though this thought that all these cows are going to calve on one specific day and using estrus synchronization as a tool, again, if we don't have the resources, the labor available, you know, that estrus synchronization, like Dr. Perry said, is not going to compensate for poor management. And if we don't have that labor available, that time that we synchronize our cows, and then all of a sudden we do happen to calve 20 cows, or yeah, we have 20 cows that calve at once. we're really just shooting ourselves in the foot anyway. So there's multiple facets to all of this, and there's multiple ways to skin a cat, but
all kinds of tools in a toolbox. It just depends on how you want to use them.
Right.
Well, and I think facilities, I mean, are obviously going to be a really important part of all this and factoring into this equation and deciding on a protocol and a lot of those things. I mean, obviously, if you're in northern Montana and you're range calving out in really remote, desolate country, you may have to factor in some additional considerations. But, you know, I think just as a general theme, the more information that we can gather and the more, you know, consolidated and kind of efficiently we can package these things to occur around timely events that we're equipped for, ready for, that can really prevent a lot of wrecks from ever occurring in the first place and setting us up for a lot more potential success down the road.
Well, one thing I can see, Kiernan, is you've got to have facilities where you can take that first 100 head of cows. They calve in the middle of March. You got to have a place, a windbreak, and some shelters for them calves where you can take that 100 cows and get rid of that group. You got to have enough paddocks or places that you can put another 100 head of cows. And then the last 60 cows, our heifers go elsewhere. We need four different places to group them. And we've got it set up where we can just walk them around this place in four or five different 50-acre pastures that it takes facilities. You got to really look at what you've got and utilize it. And we built a couple more paddocks just because this summer it was chaos. We run these cows through eight times. Georgia, with their new protocol that they had, they wanted to bleed them twice, almost a month ahead of breeding, and then bring them back in. Every week, we had 200 head of cows to run through in four different groups. And it was chaos, but it worked. And we got to the point, everybody says that, oh, geez, the more you run them cows through, the wilder they get. It is not true. Our cows, the last two, three times they come through, they come in and hit the silencer chute. They walk in and they don't hardly get up to, they got to go another inch before you get hit, shut the headlock, and they just stand there. And they get a lot calmer. We've got a nice bunch of cows because of it. So,
yeah, I think both Kiernan and I can attest to that. We were at your place a few times this last year.
We'll be ending our conversation with Dr. Perry and John Mose for this podcast, but join us for our next episode as Dr. Perry and John share more on preparing for the breeding season. Thank you to Dr. Perry for joining us from Overton, Texas, and John Mose from Mose Feedlot, LLC in Florence, South Dakota. And thank you for listening to Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information.